Hey, Mike. How you doing, man? I feel like we're hanging out frequently these days. So good to see you.
Yeah, man. Likewise, brother. How you feeling?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Despite the gloomy weather. It's good to be back. Honestly, this is like my favorite thing that I do in my in the
Oh yeah,
workday, to
most
stop in the
definitely.
middle of everything and just have good conversations with good people, man. So welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to PCWB. I am Saper Vakil, your co-host, and I'm here with my brother Mike Knight.
Yes, your co-host Mike Knight, but let's get at it because we have a high-powered, very important guest today, and I think we're limited on time. So if you please could introduce our guest so we can get going because I have a lot of questions.
Yeah, PCWB, a professor and a comedian, walking to a bar. Today we are joined by someone who's been in my circle of friends and colleagues as of recently. I'm new to Chicagoland, but we are here with a longtime Chicago resident and someone who is a recent faculty member, senior lecturer, and director of audio programming at McGill School of Journalism, Natalie Moore. We are very excited and fortunate to have you here with us. Natalie, in addition to her new appointment at Northwestern, is also a Chicago-based journalist. Her work has been published all over the place. In Essence, in Ebony, in the Chicago Reporter, in Bitch, in These Times, in the Chicago Tribune, in the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Guardian. She's gotten numerous awards. She's definitely, yeah,
WBZ,
her, I should, sh
Howard
so,
University,
and so
going crazy.
she's absolutely, so there's a bunch of reasons why I'm personally excited, but I just want to welcome you, Natalie, to the podcast and thank you for taking time in your day to be here.
Thank you all for having me.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Mike, lean in. I saw you lean in, man. You go ahead. You get us
No,
going.
I do have one. I was doing some research, as I said, Natalie, and looking into, and you had on your website, now your website one more time for our viewers.
NatalieYmoore.com.
Perfect. And I was on there, and one of your featured videos is you and a young brother, was it Ta-Nehisi? Could you help me with
Ta-Nehisi
that? Ta
Coates.
Ta Ta-Nehisi Coates. You were speaking to him, and one of the things that you had said during that interview, and I'm paraphrasing, forgive me, was something along the lines of books or journalism, like which one is more impactful? And I believe you posted, and correct me if I paraphrase wrong, but you would pose the question to Todd, but you never really answered it yourself. And for somebody who has one foot in both of those realms, did you have a preference, like either growing up, has it changed? Is it the same now that it was before? Do you have a preference? Do you see either one of those as more impactful than the other?
Oh, you dug in the crates because I don't even
Look
remember that question.
at this guy.
Ooh, yeah, I love journalism because of the quick nature of it. The information gets out, it keeps people informed. It's a form of public service. I love books because it's not the next day's fish wrap. People are still reading the hard copy, and it has a shelf life. So it's not, well, I guess journalism has been how I make my livelihood. So I should pick that one because you don't make a lot of money in books unless you're at the pinnacle.
Unless you're Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Right. So I've had success in writing books, but I'm not able to do that full time. But I would say that my journalism informs me, like everything, even every creative project that I've done, because I've stepped out of journalism. It was because of that journalism background that gave me knowledge on a topic, and being in the in daily journalism keeps you on your toes. Like you're just connected on the ground
Due
more
to your research.
with people. Yeah.
That's actually, can I jump in really quick, Mike? I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought, but one conversation, Natalie, as soon as the election results came in, and we're going to get to the elections in a minute more substantively. The day after I had class, the day after Mike had a show at the Laugh Factory. I went to class. I had class 9:30 in the morning. I saw he was performing at the Laugh Factory, and I went and caught him for his show. He was hosting. It was a packed room. Really interesting moment. And then we recorded an episode of this podcast, and one of the reflections was the difference in proximity to communities between comics and academics, right? Which is, if from my standpoint, the comedian, the artist, is much closer to the people and engaging with them in a much more intimate encounter. And I think the same is true for the reporter. And I think I'm hearing that in your comment. Is that accurate? I guess, do you have a position on it with respect to your university role now? Like, are we further away? Is my perception accurate that we are, just by the nature of the business and the work that we're doing, further away from everyday people compared to the reporter?
I don't think it has to be. I mean, reporters in a daily context are just going to be out by nature and mm-hmm. talking to people. But depending on what type of academic you are, you know, are you doing, you're in education, you're touching, if not the classroom, people who are impacting the classroom. So I don't, there is something about academia that gives you the 30,000 foot view. And this is why I have always loved to quote academics in my own work, so that there's texture and contextualization around my work. So sure, I can interview, let's say, someone living in public housing, and I'm getting their perspective. But if I'm not doing my own data set, I can rely on academics who have done studies and can give me
right
some of that background. So I don't, and again, it depends on the type of academic you are. Of course, being at a school like Northwestern, it is an elite institution, but I have found that being in the classroom lets you know the pulse of what at least a segment of young people are thinking. I used to adjunct at Columbia College, and I learned about YouTube from them in 2006.
Sure.
So I think that classroom experience is something to take
note
of too.
That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, just the proximity to young people is going to be a certain window into society that not everyone gets to have. I take that point. But let's talk about this pulse, the pulse that we get, right, from these different positions, these different vantage points that the three of us sort of have. Academia for me and you, Natalie, but you also have the reporting angle, and then Mike as a comedy producer, podcaster, and comic in relation to the recent elections, right? And so if I can provide a bit of context for our listeners, and go back a little bit more in time, again, Natalie, to some of your earlier work. And so in 2016, your book titled The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation, received lots of recognition and accolades. I have yet to read it, I'll admit, but it's on my list. It's on my list, and I look forward to getting a copy and getting it signed at the next gathering at Reggie and Maxine's. But thinking of, so that book was known for a deep dive into the kind of political and economic history and status of Chicago South Side. And I'm curious to know, from a political standpoint, there's a lot of conversation, right, in the media about men of color, Black men in particular, shifting more towards Trump, and the general shifts and kind of changes and dynamics of Trump's supporters this time around. I guess in relation to your work and the insights that came from that book, are you hearing those narratives as well in the current discussions of Chicago politics? Does it resonate? Does it not? Like, how do you react to it from your deep knowledge of that space?
There are a few things, and the data is still coming out. And WBEZ did a story that came out that said, yes, Trump doubled his numbers in Chicago, but more importantly, Democrats stayed home. So you have to, again, like, people do all these hot takes the day after,
right,
a week after. We're going to be talking about the results of this and relying on political scientists, relying on academics to help us see a fuller picture. Journalists can do some of that data work now, at least, you know, hyper local. So on one hand, we were saying, oh my gosh, Trump's support doubled. But all right, 2 weeks after that, oh, well, here's this other thing that happened. You know, I believe the number, you know, Biden maybe got fewer than 100. Joe Biden got more than 100,000 votes more compared to Harris. So if Democrats hadn't stayed home with that support, you know, what would that look like? So I think, yeah, context is important, and looking and fully understanding Chicago, because, you know, Mal Greenwood went for Trump on the far southwest side in 2016, you know, a white neighborhood that, you know, by the way, is middle class. You know, not, you know, we've got to continue to complicate the so-called working class narrative. The other thing that I'm going to be keeping my eye on, that I think a lot of Chicagoans are too, is what does a Trump has loved to shit on Chicago. He did that all through his first term. And will he continue to do that? And now that he is, you know, bloodthirsty for revenge, by his own admission, going after people who don't agree with him, what does that look like for the leadership of Chicago? What does it look like for projects such as the Red Line extension? What does that look like for, you know, lead pipe replacement? What does that look like for, is he going to call in the National Guard if something pops off here?
Natalie, can I ask you, this might be next to impossible. If you were able to snap your fingers and get rid of all of your knowledge, all of your research, your journalistic history, all the books you've ever read, and all the data you've accumulated, most of which you forgot, I'll never know, right? What is the feeling? Why did what just happen? Why did that vote just take place? Your feeling when you're at the salon, when you're talking to your auntie and no data, just your gut feeling. What just happened? Why did it turn the direction that it went?
Well, I don't think there's a way to turn that off, but I would just say, you know, white supremacy is a hell of a drug. And people can talk about, you know, like y'all really think fascism is worth the cost of cheaper bacon, that you don't even know if you're going to get cheaper bacon. Like this is what it is. You know, we're hearing that this is a pocketbook issue. We're hearing that it's an economic issue. Now, people can vote for who they want to vote for in a democracy. But I also think that people are just playing on our faces by acting like these eggs are worth so much. And again, there's no guarantee that egg prices will drop, but all the other things that come with a Trump presidency, in his own words, is worth that. It's not. It's so-called woke ideology, you know, making America great again. You know, the proximity to whiteness if you're not white, and, you know, sexism and racism.
To refer back to your book on the South Side, it did tackle like gerrymandering, redlining districts, things of that nature. And a question I had, it's a story I might have even told on this podcast, but I grew up in a military family. So I went to school, my elementary and high school, like all over the world. So Japan, England, you know, Okinawa, a handful of states. There was one particular time I was in mainland Japan. I might have been in 10th grade, and our social studies teacher, we had assigned seating, and he had the desk in a certain kind of order. And the next day, the teacher said, "Hey, tomorrow you guys come into class, sit wherever you want," right? And we got to class the next day. He had everything set up, a rank file, just a grid, just, you know, five, six desks that way, five, six desks that way, filled out. told us all to sit wherever we wanted. When we got in the class, and mark you, I'm in Japan, military base. So there's every nationality, every blend of every nationality you could think of, a few Japanese natives and the like, right? And when we started the class, the teacher looked at everybody. He said, all right, now what do you see? And when we stopped to look, everybody just sat next to their social groups, their friends, right? And when we stopped to look, all the black kids, we were in a section. All the white kids were in their section. All the Japanese kids were in the section. The Filipino kids were over there. Hispanic kids were over there. Without any prompts, he just said, sit wherever you want. And I still don't know exactly what the lesson is that I learned that day. And then I moved to Chicago and I went, I still don't necessarily have the answer, but you look at Chicago and it was verbatim what that social studies teacher did in that class. Is that a part of like redlining districts or gerrymandering, or is that a part of human conditioning, or in your research, what do you see it as?
Yeah, I would say it's absolutely not redlining. And, you know, Sapere is the social scientist here, not me, but you're talking about when you're in Japan, adolescent development and people wanting to be around people like them. And your taste in music, your culture, like things are, and I believe that these types of formations really start like around maybe seventh grade when your identity starts to be formed. Please jump in, Pear, if I am like messing up research.
No, you got it.
Okay. And so this is something that I am very clear about in my work. Segregation and self-selection are two different things. So teenagers, young people deciding to form a clique or hang out because of a shared experience is different than a bank turning you down for a loan, or the government drawing lines around a neighborhood and saying, don't give loans here. Different laws and policies are why we have segregation. And when people say people want to live around people like themselves, you know, I push back and say, well, how were you able to buy this house? Why did you choose, you know, and what is choice? So these are, you know, look at the inequities in our public school system. We look at food injustice, high rates of preventable diseases. Like this is what happens from segregation. This is not about self-selection. Now, that said, people do want to be in communities with other people. And the opposite of segregation isn't about having quotas. It's about removing barriers from people's lives to be able to live, work, and play and do the things that they want to do.
Yeah, if I could quickly add a little bit to that, everything Natalie said, and Mike, one book that you might be interested in, you and our viewers here, you know, who are interested in questions of not just race and identity, but this question of selection, right? There's a famous book in education in the social sciences written by Beverly Daniel Tatum, titled "Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?"
I knew you were going to say that book. Yeah,
it's literally, so it's like literally, Mike, you have to read this.
That's
book.
A derivative title.
You have to read that, right? Like you have to read this
for
book
sure.
Now. You can't bring up the story another time before you read this book, because it's actually right at it connects to your. I mean, and I think the international context is super fascinating, and I appreciate you always bringing that up. But basically, and I've read this book a long time ago. Right? It was in grad school. But if I can remember correctly, that one of the basic premises was that the work of building your identity as a young person is a complicated business, and there's added stressors and barriers and obstructors for kids of color broadly, for black kids in particular. And this this happened. I remember in my high school, I went to a predominantly white high school, but there was some diversity. But I remember the table of black kids, and one of those black kids is my best friend to this day, Timmy Tope, who comes up in this podcast a couple of times. We're gonna have to have him on the pod soon.
Shout out, Tim.
Timmy Tope. So it was a process that everyone's seen. It's familiar, but one of the major arguments from Tatum is that the marginalization that happens in school broadly necessitates spaces, informal and formal, that are protective in some nature in some regard. So that's one reference. The other piece that comes to mind is my wife's work and her so Kiana Mariah Ross, Dr. Kiana Mariah Ross, who's also a professor here at Black Studies. She doesn't read or listen to this work, but she's going to, because we're too busy these days. But I'm going to have her listen to this podcast and give her opinion. But I bring her up, Mike, because her work speaks to the very complex history of what happened to American schools post Brown versus Board, right? Post the Supreme Court decision that schools must integrate, right? She digs into this little known history of a lot of Black communities that actually didn't want to integrate and actually preferred having all Black majority Black schools. And the argument is that it's not the integration and proximity to whiteness that a lot of Black families wanted. It was the resources, right? It was the resources and the high quality educational spaces. And so she does work in this area of research known as Black Studies. And she talks about Black space and education. Like, what does it look like? Why is it important? Where does it emerge? And some of these politics are playing out here, right here in Evanston, right outside the campus here at Northwestern, where there's this fascinating history of a Black school being shut down in the historically African-American Fifth Ward of Evanston, and the decades-long effort to regain. So Evanston currently, 2024, every single ward except the Fifth Ward has its own school. Right. And the school board voted recently, a couple years ago, to reopen a school in the Fifth Ward. And it speaks to this very same issue of, you know, which communities get access to schools, which communities get access to their own spaces. And it doesn't all the way satisfy, Mike, your kind of the memory you have of like, this is why I in that moment, or how do we self-select? But I think the point that Natalie is making, and I agree with it, is that we can't think about choice and self-selection outside of the politics of exclusion and segregation and, you know, the harm that's happened. But, you know, there is the cultural piece. Like, we all like to be around our own people. And I think that's an element as well. So hopefully I didn't complicate it too much, but that's what comes to mind. That's what comes to mind for me.
Well, speaking of school, as what appears to be a lifelong learner and academic, Natalie, what kind of a student were you in school? If I could go back and find somebody from 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade and be like, what was Natalie like? What do you think they'd say?
Well, I was a better student in elementary school, I would say. And I was a good student in high school, but high school was around the time. I mean, I was always really good at English, reading, you know, social studies, that sort of thing. Math and science were harder. But I would say in high school, this one
people are saying you were a partier, but somehow still got good grades. You were low key. You were quiet, helpful, a little bit of a bully.
But definitely not a bully. I knew I wanted to be a journalist pretty early on. So, you know, ever since like eighth grade, I did summer programs. I was editor, worked on my high school newspaper, and, you know, ended up being co-editor in chief. I would say that grades were important to me, but that's around the time that I formulated like working hard and playing hard and working smart, not hard. And so I was like, well, I'd rather get some B's if I can have a social life. Like, I wasn't someone.
Nobody says that.
And I mean, and let's be real, there's no guarantee I would have been getting straight A's anyway, especially not in like physics or chemistry, but
right.
I have always valued balance, and I wasn't someone, I read a lot, and that was for fun. But I had friends, I went out. Chicago in the 90s was a great place to be a teenager.
So you still outstepping a little bit, but you made sure you got your papers in.
Right, and it's like, I got freedom at home. All right, well, I can go out if I do the things I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Where is with, because we were briefly touching on it before we hopped on with AI. I mean, that affects everybody, on the whether it's professor, whether it's journalism, whether it's the new media, whether it's comedy, whether it's playwrights, whatever part of it, starting to encroach on creativity and information as a whole. Where are you seeing this in the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? What is, how does that impact all the worlds that you have a foothold in?
We have to learn how to live with AI. And so I can joke with my students that I'm old and say, don't use ChatGPT and show them why, because the information is wrong. But we all use it in some, you know, where there's a chat box when we're online trying to book a plane ticket or dispute a charge with our bank. Or, you know, I saw on my phone, this cracked me up, like there's AI on my text messaging that says, you know, quit a job, break up with a boyfriend, and it will write these things for you, which is pretty hilarious and perhaps scary at the same time. So we have to figure out not to be, and younger people know this, like I'm not a digital native to this. So I have to keep an open mind. But there's also theft that's happening. The book, The South Side, was stolen. That's in that big, you know, lawsuit that's happening with authors whose work was taken without their permission. There's also, but you know, there are benefits for transcribing tape. But I was telling students that you have to double check this because there are mistakes. So in 5 to 10 years, you know, I think we're going to see a reduction in some jobs, and journalism is not immune from that. I think public relations jobs are closer to being threatened, but how do we take that technology that can help us and not be afraid of it, and also make sure that it doesn't take away jobs that people need and that they can do?
So, Perry and Natalie, do you see a future where a group of students walk into a classroom that's conducted by a computer, by AI? It has a curriculum and it just sits up there on the screen and goes, today's lesson is blah, 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 blah. Is this a possibility? Not at all.
I mean, I don't think in the near term. I think you can play it out and you can imagine, given how, I mean, given the huge advance in the technology that like OpenAI represents from previous, you know, chatbots, like it is tremendous, like what it can do. I'm not trying to downplay that at all. But from there, I think people's imagination has a warped sense of like time scale. So I think because of that leap, people are saying, oh my God, in 2 years, we're going to have, you know, a sentient. No, I think those claims are overhyped in my view and from my understanding of the literature and the complexity in an educational environment, the importance of human relationships. And there's a huge literature on this, and the complexity of what happens between humans in a classroom is orders of magnitude beyond the complexity of the latest algorithm in OpenAI you know what I mean? And so I think people don't appreciate that gap. Now, is there going to be constantly, you know, work done on thinking about how do you use AI for, you know, human computer interaction? Yeah, but I don't think we're as close to that. So I'm not wasting my time worried about that just yet. I'm good. You know, I have a few more decades of teaching. I think I'm good. Now the next generation, I don't know. We have to see. How about you, Natalie? What's the best case? How are journalists in the world of journalism and reporting? Are there enthusiasts of AI? Because in education, it's a debate.
Oh, that's people, a good one. Yeah.
There's a big debate. There's people who are like super enthusiastic about how AI is going to transform education, and some people who have the exact opposite. I think I'm somewhere probably in the middle. But I'm curious about what that debate looks like in the world of journalism.
How many journalists are using ChatGPT? Come on, spill the beans, Natalie.
I don't know, but I can say in newsrooms it's looked down upon by and large.
Okay.
That you should not be doing your work that way. And even if it exists, it's not.
It's taboo.
It's not accepted, at least not for like writing or trying to get sources. Otter AI is used for transcripts and for, you know, transcribing interviews and tape. But I mean, I've had reporters who have had to do corrections to the digital version of their story because they were cutting and pasting the transcript and it wasn't accurate. Like one word could be off. So they're cautionary tales. Like it in a, yeah, I mean, I hate transcribing tape. I hate logging tape. But in, and I'm, you know, do audio journalism. But if you're cutting that tape and you're listening to it, that's different versus, all right, now I'm doing a digital story that may have more of this interview in it because I have more space. You have to be diligent in double checking.
And full disclosure, Otter AI is a sponsor of PCWB. So no, just kidding. Just kidding.
Oh, I was like, for real?
I'll take it. I'll do an ad read.
But like, that's,
you know, you're like, what's going on here?
Is there a way back? Or maybe I'm talking out of school. Is legacy journalism ever gonna go away? They made a song forever ago that what was it? Video killed the radio star or whatever, but radio's still here.
I would say that anytime a new medium comes about, you know, people said radio would be dead because of TV, because of movies, and then was movies would be dead because of TV. So I don't think so. I think adapting and evolving is key, but I don't think it will go away.
How about you, Mike? What are comedians? Are y'all like, you know, 5 minutes before you're called up to the stage, typing in ChatGPT, give me a good, like, how are you guys using it?
ChatGPT is on that stage, bro. You better believe it. You better believe
how,
ChatGPT
like, so
is
are,
on that
is,
stage.
Is that considered theft? If some, like, are people asking, tell me a joke about XYZ and then
well,
using
that's
that?
The thing. So you'll see, recently they had the whole Drake versus everybody beef, right? And one of the biggest holes that somebody poked in Drake's thing is that they started bringing out that he was getting assistance on writing his lyrics. And so until anybody knew that, if you would have asked the layman on the street, hey, you think Drake gets help writing his lyrics? You'd probably go, yeah, and you would stop thinking about it. But when you actually see the evidence, when you actually hear the reference tracks, when you actually see a video of somebody singing the lyrics before Drake got a hold of them, that hits you mentally. It diminishes. So do I think a decent chunk of people on the scene right now are using tablet? Of course, I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. People writing sketches or skits for their social medias or just getting joke help, or maybe they got writer's block. I see it firsthand, but nobody's ever gonna go around and brag about it. Unless somebody, that's their base and then they do it as a gimmick. But otherwise, people are just gonna do it under cover of darkness and try and get away with it as long as possible. And if they get called out for it, that's gonna be a hell of a thing, because we have roast battles in the city. So if you're on stage and somebody drops the bomb, then that's why you ChatGPT your whole, that's an Eminem 8.5 mile moment right there. So there and it's not going away. The Pandora's box is open.
So Kendrick Lamar definitely ridiculed Drake a little bit for his use of AI, right?
Yeah.
We're hearing from Natalie the cultural mood in the reporter's room amongst comics. Clearly, it's kind of, you know, maybe taboo, but it's kind of happening under the radar. But let me put a different perspective on it. I'm just kind of playing with this idea. But there's a social psychologist very well known in the field of psychology and education. He's long gone now, but he's Russian social psychologist Lev Vygotsky. And he's sort of a foundational thinker and theorist and scholar in this space, really talking about the way that human thought is wrapped up with language and social interactions, right? So he's one of the first to kind of lay that foundation. And a famous line from Vygotsky is something to the effect of, there's no such thing as an original thought. Every single thing that happens in any particular individual's brain has already happened on the social plane of existence, right? Even this is a way before the internet, way before, you know, ChatGPT. And so from that perspective, right, if we are all engaging with our environment, with our families and our communities, our students, our colleagues, and we're learning, and that learning is somehow translating and being reconfigured and reassembled into what we would recognize as original thought that we then speak out of our mouths or comes out of our writing, how different is that than what basically is underpinning, you know, these AI tools, right? So it's like, how different if we're doing a search on Google? I mean, I'm not talking about the extremes. Obviously, if you have an essay to write or a joke to write, you tell ChatGPT to write it and it spits it out and you use it. Sure, that's an obvious case of an unethical use of a tool. But isn't there a lot of devils in the detail, like using AI, if it's to spark ideas and get inspiration, how different is that from talking to a friend or being on the bus and overhearing a conversation that sparks an idea? What do you guys think? Am I on?
It's perspective, because I'm a big fan of Quentin Tarantino, and he'll tell you he's stealing right in front of your face when you watch his movies. I mean, Einstein said he was standing on the shoulder. He needed Newton. I mean, Malcolm Martin, civil rights movement needed Marcus Garvey. I mean, everybody's walking through a path that somebody else carved to a large degree. But I don't know. What would you say, Natalie? Because I think please let us know everything and how we could follow you, where anybody can get some more information from you, because I don't think we have much too longer with you. But what would you say?
Well, I think this is why we have to keep having conversations and don't say, no, this is horrible, and shut down the ethics around it or even the creativity around it. And having these type of formalized and informal conversations is important. So I was just dying to know, can I do a joke? So Northwestern wants us to use Microsoft Pilot instead of ChatGPT, for example, because, you know, that's who we're, you know, have a license with. So I just typed in, help me tell a joke about Trump.
On the podcast, live.
Here we go.
Yeah, this just in, breaking news. Are you dying to hear what it said?
I am.
I can't contain myself.
I am sorry. I don't know how to discuss this topic. Why don't we talk about something else?
ChatGPT don't want to lose his tenure.
Copilot.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Both funded by Microsoft.
Yeah, I'm just like my mom. I call everything Nintendo.
That's okay. Interesting, though.
So then I put in, help me tell a joke. And then it wrote, sure, here's a lighthearted joke for you. Why don't scientists trust atoms? Because they make up everything. And then it wrote, I hope that brought a smile to your face. If you need another joke or anything else, just let me know. So, you know, in 5 years, will these jokes be better? Probably, because it's taking from human experience, but we will always need human experience to help these machines, I think, in the technology.
Before we wrap, one last thing. What just literally just happened when you pulled that experiment and it said, hey, sorry, I don't know how to joke about that. Is that right that whoever programmed it said, hey, if you hear this word, don't say shit. Hey, zip your lip. Is that safe that somebody else is controlling?
Well, I put in, tell me a joke about Kamala Harris. Life, this just in, and it gave the same answer.
Is that safe for them to have those kinds of those on, or should it be, hey, say what you're gonna say?
Well, I think it's safe if you're a comedian and you're not stealing. I don't know. And that other joke about Adams, like, I don't think that's something you or your peers can do at the Laugh Factory without getting booed off the stage. So,
I'm opening with that, just as my own experiment.
So,
no, but I think it's super interesting because, you know, what Natalie got back in that response is a reflection of, you know, all these attempts to provide guardrails around a technology that's exploding all across the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you got to think about issues of safety and trust and ethics and AI responsibility. These are connected to all those, but it's that's so distinct from what happens in the and you know, at your job, right? When you guys go in, it's not that it's anything goes. It's not that, because there is a communal aspect and there is the risk of getting booed off stage. But the limits of what you all can say are I think the parameters are much, much broader. Mike told me to go with one of those roast battles. He's like, "Oh, have you checked out a roast?" And I'm like, "No, I haven't." Natalie, I don't know if you've been to one of these.
I have not.
I went to one at Zany's. And I like to pride myself in being pretty, you know, I'm not easily offended or like clutching my pearls. But oh my goodness. I was like, really? You guys can joke? Like, and everyone's okay. And like, everyone was just having a good time. Things that were completely off the grid from an academic standpoint. But I just think those questions, to get kind of philosophical with it, the questions around ethics and free speech, right? We know those are the questions that the higher education is confronted with right now. They're very political, they're very loaded, and what's going to happen in the next few years is going to probably define the next generation of academics and what is being researched and said. But I think it's very different from what happens in the space of art, right, and comedy, and it should be, and people should be thinking about those ethics and context specific ways. And we can't create ethics for what gets said on ChatGPT and apply it willy-nilly to the classroom or the comedy club. I think we have to think about it with an insider's lens in each of those spaces.
Absolutely. NatalieYMoore.com. Also WBEZ. Please, there's too many superlatives for me to remember right now, but if you could please give a rundown and also how people could find you. Also where they can grab the books, plural.
Well, I would say support independent bookstores. Please don't order from Amazon. So wherever you like to buy books, support the independent bookstores. You gave my website, and yeah, that's the best place to find me.
Natalie, do you have something coming up that's exciting for you? You have a speaking engagement, or just, I mean, your new plateau at Northwestern?
I've got some stuff cooking. Probably shouldn't say quite yet.
You almost got the break.
Yeah. Oh no, I do have a podcast coming out in January, a limited series about the social impact and history of soap operas, which were started in Chicago in the 1930s.
Stories? You're doing a story on stories.
I'm doing something on stories. Yes.
Love it. I love it. Well, Natalie, we're lucky to have you at Northwestern. We're super lucky to have you on PCWB. Thank you for kind of taking a slice out of your Tuesday and coming to join us.
Thank you. Folks, thank you.
Absolutely. Everyone, listeners, it was a pleasure. Again, I'm Saper Vakil, your co-host.
Yeah. And I'm your co-host, Mike Knight. If you enjoyed the content, please take a moment to like. Helps us out a lot. Please also subscribe. Please make sure you follow NatalieYMoore.com and anything that she has going on social media. She's very impactful and important person in Chicago, let alone the nation and beyond. I'm your co-host, Michael Knight, with PCWB, with my co-host.
Saper Vakil, and white supremacy is one hell of a drug. I like that line. I'm gonna use that one.
Well, you know, I was trying to play with Dave Chappelle Rick James.
I think I remember something. Yeah. Thank you so much, Natalie.
This is so dope.
All right, everybody. Have a good
day.
All right, Peace. Mike.